So they have a hypothesis. They've done some studies, and they have a hypothesis that may be wrong, but I think it's worth sharing with you. They have noticed all the things I've mentioned so far, and they're obviously well aware of Velikovsky's work, but they have a different view, and they have access to different information than Velikovsky did. They notice that if they study the Bible and the Talmud and the Mishnah and the ancient Hebrew records, that in the Bible one can identify seven major what they call catastrophes. This includes Sodom and Gomorrah, the Exodus. Incidentally, they separate the flood as a special situation. I won't get into that right now. But the they start, actually what they do is they start with the days of Peleg, the Tower of Babel, Sodom and Gomorrah, some catastrophes that occurred during the days of Job, the Exodus, the long day of Joshua, some things that happened in the days of Deborah and Samuel, two things that happened in the days of David, Elijah, Joel, Amos, and the big thing, the big one that we want to talk a little bit about is on Isaiah, during the time of Isaiah in 701 B.C. Now, when they look at all of this and they start analyzing it, they discover some interesting things. They discover, first of all, that all of these things appear to have occurred in either March or October, which is kind of interesting, October 25th or March 20th or 21st. They also discover that there's about 108 years or some multiple of that between each one of these. And they said, gee, that period is kind of interesting. And to get to a long, to make a long story short, they notice a couple of things, that three of them occur on March 20th, 21st, four of them occur on October 25th out of the major seven. Two of them occur in the 8th century B.C., two of them occur in the 15th century B.C., and two of them occur in the 20th century. So they're fascinated by the fact they seem to, some of them, you know, they seem to occur in pairs and yet separated by multiples of 108 years. Now, I'm going to sort of get ahead of the story, but so you can see where I'm headed. They notice that Mars has an orbit of 687 days, the Earth 365. They're not quite 2-to-1. They have built a computer model, which, if correct, goes to explain most of what we're going to talk about tonight. They believe that there's good evidence to suspect that Mars was originally on a 2-to-1 orbit to the Earth. Take the Earth at 360 days, Mars at 720, and overlap the orbits so that Mars, the orbit of Mars, would intersect the orbit of the Earth every March and October. But it would be 2-to-1. It would thus intersect the Earth every 54 years, but not necessarily close by. And when they go through this model, they notice that on a couple of cases, it would pass very closely. Going back to the days of Job, it would come within 120,000 miles. The Earth is about 200. Well, to give you some feeling here, let me back up. Mars' furthest distance from the Earth would be about 210.7 million miles. It's way, way out there. The Earth is about 240,000 miles from the Earth. The Earth, to give you some feeling, is at perihelion. That is the point it's closest to the Sun. It's about 90,700,000 miles, about 8 minutes in the speed of light. When it's furthest from the Sun, called aphelion, perihelion is when it's closest to the Sun, aphelion is furthest from the Sun, is about 93.7 million miles. In other words, about 3 million miles difference from 90.7 to 93.7. Million miles. Mars would come as close as 81,900,000 miles, and that was closer to the Sun than the Earth, certain times, and go way further out, 210.7 million miles at its aphelion. But it crosses the Earth in two places, the orbits do, in March and October. As you can probably gather, from time to time, Mars would pass very close to the Earth. How close? Well, in the days of Job, about 120,000 miles at its nearest point. During the days of Exodus, 60,000 miles on an outside flyby. In the long day of Joshua, about 70,000 miles on a northern polar orbit. We'll come back to that. In the days of Deborah, about 150,000, Samuel, 150,000, David, 200,000 and 120, Elijah, 150,000, Joel, Amos, about 120,000. In the days of Isaiah, 70,000. Now, when something like Mars comes close, that close to the Earth, some impressive things could happen. First of all, you and I may not realize that there are crustal tides on the Earth. We know there's water tides by the Moon and the Sun and so forth, mostly the Moon, because it's closer. And they're about 2 or 3 inches max. If Mars was within 70,000 miles past of the Earth, you would have crustal tides of more than 85 feet. That tends to be a little rough on buildings, on walls of cities. Now, we're going to discover that the ancients expected this. They didn't know how bad it would be, but they knew that about every 108 years, something might happen. And they even planned their battles that way. When the Assyrian army camps outside Jerusalem, there's some evidence to believe they were hoping there'd be a catastrophe to bring the walls down. What they didn't know is a bolide would wipe 185,000 of them out, if a bolide is the explanation of the angel described in the scripture. One of the theories that I'm obviously leading up to is, when Mars, let's say, I forget which way it is, if it leads the Earth, it loses energy, gives energy to the Earth. If it lags, it picks up energy. In other words, there's an energy transfer between the orbit of Mars and the orbit of the Earth when they come near each other. And it is believed by these scientists, they have the most data of the most recent one, which is 701 BC, that at that pass, the last of these seven, there was enough energy transfer to shorten the Mars orbit from 720 days to 690. There's still 3 days between then and today. Something else happened. They have some theories, but they're not sure. The Earth went from 360 days to 365 and a quarter. So the calendar adjustment they attribute to the near pass of Mars in the days of Isaiah, where all these calendars all over the world changed. That raises a question of, gee, if there's that also involves several things with the Earth, not just the orbit changing, but it also involves the spin axis changing, the location of the poles changing, and such. There's a change in axis, a change in the number of days per year, some field reversals. Now, let me give you a little feeling for... let me focus first of all on BC, 701. At the time we're talking about, we have a number of interesting eyewitnesses. Rabshakeh, Sennacherib, Shebna, Micah, Habakkuk, Hezekiah, Manasseh, and Isaiah. And if you go through the scriptures and pick up the language out of particularly Habakkuk chapter 3, Psalm 46, Isaiah 36, and so on and so forth, you hear them speak of the mountains melting, being uprooted and moved out of their place. As you read that, as you and I read those passages, we call it figurative language, poetry. And we ascribe to much of what Habakkuk says in chapter 3 as just being literary. What'll shake you up after understanding the orbital mechanics of what could be the explanation for all this, they're describing eyewitness accounts of the last of these 70,000 mile passes. It might be before I get into that, let me give you some more facts. The current perihelion I don't know if all these statistics mean a lot to you. Maybe I should get off this. We're going to get into discussions a little bit here of the spin axis and so forth. One of the things that's interesting, Steinhauer, Patton, and Hatch predict that if this happened on the Earth, it also probably happened on Mars. That is, an adjustment of the spin axis and those kinds of things. Because it turns out that Mariner 9, pictures from Mariner 9, shows a number of 200 square mile plates on the Earth, on Mars, that have a number of colored lines, and one of the theories to explain the colored lines is that it's captured frozen dust, and it gives rise to the theory that Mars's orbit shift of the axis shifted at least 4 or 5 times, maybe 6 or 7 times in its history. The 6 or 7 intrigues me because of the 7 passes that Hatch and this had predicted. Maybe it would be useful to take a look at Habakkuk chapter 3. Habakkuk chapter 3. If nothing else, it'll be useful because it'll let you find Habakkuk. page 953 in your New Scofield. Okay. As you read through this, it may be just figurative language of a prophet that's in prayer and in praise and so forth, but it's kind of interesting to see the language of Habakkuk, who lived, by the way, about the 7th century B.C., and he's praising God. In verse 3, he says, God came from Teman and from the Holy One from Mount Paran, Shelah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was like the light. And he had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and the burning coals went forth at his feet. And he stood and measured the earth, and beheld, and drove asunder the nations. And the everlasting mountains were scattered, and the perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was the Lord displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked, according to the oaths of the tribes, even thy word. And he goes on like this. The mountains saw thee, and they trembled. The overflowing water passed by, and so on. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation, and didst thresh the nations in anger, and so on. This is Habakkuk. It sounds like he may have been an eyewitness, is the suggestion, okay? If you read Micah chapter 1, we won't take the time now. In chapter 7, 6, and elsewhere, you'll find that Micah makes reference to catastrophes in Sodom and Gomorrah, Exodus, and the long day of Joshua before, in talking about a situation that he's facing there, and he wrote approximately the 8th century B.C. But you might turn to Psalm 46. We all know Psalm 46. We encounter it from time to time. But in this spirit, it's kind of interesting to see the prayer of the psalmist here. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Hey, that's not your everyday worry, is it? Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Hey, you can talk about volcanoes and stuff, but it doesn't come close to what he seems to be afraid of. There is a river, the streams thereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her, and she shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. The nations rage, and the kingdoms were moved. He uttereth his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow, he cutteth the spear asunder, he burneth the chariot with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. There are these kinds of passages in the Psalms, and you read these, well, say it's a little flowery language maybe, a little, you know, poetic license. Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe that's written to a people who had something to sweat. Now, we could go through more of these things. Isaiah 13 is a good chapter. Let's not shortchange this. This is as long as I took you to Velikovsky and the Steinhauer book. Let's not shortchange the more reliable record, namely the Word of God itself. So let's just take sort of a swing through. Let's talk to Isaiah a little bit. We could go into others, into Micah and what have you, but let's take Isaiah. Turn to chapter 13, okay? And just sort of hear Isaiah a little bit. Chapter 13, verse 4, the noise of a multitude in the mountains, as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Now this could be, of course, prophetic in terms of the end time, or it might be, and maybe it's double, both. In other words, maybe it's the end times, maybe it's cosmological, or maybe it's both. And it speaks of the day of the Lord, of course. I'll get down to verse 13. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of its place. Oh, really? You mean the orbit's changed? Yeah. And the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. And on he goes. We might turn to chapter 24. Let's turn to chapter 24. Of Isaiah. interesting verse that opens chapter 24. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. Now that might be future. That might be, you know, a revelation correlated kind of verse. Or maybe it had something to do with the Tower of Babel. Or maybe several. We can skim on here, but let's just pick it up about verse 18. And shall come pass on that day that he that fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall in the pit, and he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in a snare, for the windows of the from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is thoroughly dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. Now, this might refer to, you know, end time stuff. No question about it. But notice verse 20. And the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a booth, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day the Lord of hosts shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high. And this is obviously end time in many ways. The earth shall reel to and fro. How interesting. Does that sound like a wobble, like an adjustment in the precession of the earth? There's evidence that the latitude of Jerusalem has changed at least 5, maybe 12 degrees over the last several thousand years. And one of the explanations is a shift of the poles, shift of the precession, a shift of the location of the poles, and a change in the spin axis. There's about a 5-minute difference in the day, by the way, if that really bothers you. No wonder the days seem shorter today. We can look at chapter 28 and pick up a few things. Verse 2, Behold, the Lord, like a mighty and strong one, who like a tempest of hail and destroying storm, like a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with a hand, and goes on. There's more of this. One more, 34. Chapter 34 might be an interesting stop by as we sort of swing through this. You might look at verse 4 of chapter 34, Isaiah. And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together like a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down, and like a leaf falleth from the vines, like a falling fig from the fig tree. These, of course, are possibly, very likely, end time, day of the Lord prophecies on the one hand. On the other hand, they may also have had a more local fulfillment than either one of us have ever suspected. Okay? Now, getting back to the idea of this Mars near pass. I want to dramatize that a little bit for you. If Mars comes that close, there's a perturbation, obviously, of the Earth's orbit. There's an energy transfer. And there's two kinds of opportunities. If the Mars is a little ahead of the Earth, getting at the junction point, or a little after the Earth. And especially if it's a polar orbit that comes over the North Pole, it really alters things. And so that when you go through the orbital mechanics, it explains something like 30 to 45 days loss in one case, and on the Mars case, and the Earth, 3 to 4 days. And that explains, incidentally, the Mars going from 720 down to 690. There's still 3 days, because today at 687, there's the supposition that it's also entangled with Jupiter in some respects. What we see is the solar system, after it's settled down and gotten in balance, what the history of the Earth may still have record of is while it was still going through some adjustments. And that's really what Patton, Hatch, and Steinhauer suggest. Reversal of geomagnetic fields. Severe crustal tides, I've mentioned that. Severe tidal waves. And a wobble, of course, or a change of precession of the spin axis. Polar migration, change in tilt, and change in spin rate. Now, let's talk about 701 B.C., according to what the computer model would have predicted. On the 20th of March in 701 B.C., about 2 hours after sunrise at 8 a.m., mathematically, it's just after sunrise. We see coming out of the sun about that time Mars with its dark side to the Earth, but a very thin crescent, extremely bright. It's gradually overtaking the sun on an inside flyby. At the midday, at about 6 p.m. in Palestine, it would be at about 70,000 miles. It would appear about 50 times the size of the moon in area. Okay? It would, about 8 p.m., start to be diminishing. It would have start going further away. By this time, you'd see three-quarters of it as a crescent. This is at night. It'd be pretty bright. It's reflecting the sun, of course. We'd see about 80-foot crustal tides. We will have entered, in anticipation, both before and after, the magnetic sheath around Mars, which is carrying all this debris, asteroids, probably from a fragmented planet called Electra, which is speculated mathematically there's a missing planet, and they think it broke up, because when two of these things get within certain radii of each other, the gravitational poles will fractionate one of them, and they think that's what happened to to what planet, which they arbitrarily call Electra. But the point is, these bolides and meteors enter the Earth about 33,000 miles an hour and cause all kinds of interesting things to happen. About 5 1/4 days are picked up on the Earth's orbit. 70% of that's of that is from orbital expansion, and about 30% due to spin rate increase, and so on. And this gets into a whole discussion of the sundial of Ahaz, which shows up in 2 Kings 20. I won't take the time now. It ends up, about of the 5 1/4 days, about 3.5 to 4 days are counted by this pass-by alone. Now, the earlier pass-bys probably added a day or two, but it wasn't off enough to really get everybody shook up. Are you with me? Total of 5 1/4 end up being needed before it's all over. Now, we know the most about the one in Isaiah because it's 701 B.C. It's most recent and best documented in a variety of ways, as I say, accompanied with tidal waves and what have you. As we go back through history, biblical history, further back we go, the less certain we are, other than the computer model dating. And what they have done at some length is to try to integrate the evidence from not only the scriptures but the Talmud and the rest. And they can pretty well, the long day of Joshua appears to have occurred on October 25th, and and probably 1404 B.C. Now, what's interesting here too, by the way, before we leave this idea, is to talk about the Phaeton myth. There is a strange myth in Greek mythology, in the case of Phaeton, and there is the same myth among the Maori tribes in New Zealand. And the Greeks called him Phaeton. He's the son of Helios in their structure. And he was responsible for a chariot they called the Sun. In Maori legends, the guy's name is Maui. Probably, I guess it's the same name after the island of Maui, but that's all another issue. But the story, the Greek mythology, has Phaeton, who's the son of Helios. He wants the car. Hey, Dad, can I drive the car tonight? Okay. He talks Helios up against his better judgment to take the chariot of the Sun. Wraps his hand so he won't get scorched, takes over the chariot of the Sun, and as he starts driving it through the zodiac, he loses control. The steeds go out of control. They bang against a couple of constellations. And Zeus, seeing that unless he did something, he's going to scorch the earth and destroy it, strikes him dead with a thunderbolt, and from that point on, Helios never let someone take the car out again. Now, in this whole legend and in the folklore of the Greek mythology, this Phaeton myth has been much studied by the cosmologists because there's some in the details that I'm sparing you of the legend as to which constellations he bumped into and so forth. There's a striking similarity to the time of Joshua and the day of the sun and so forth, where incidentally, according to their model, it isn't that the earth reversed its rotation as Velikovsky suggests, which is a bit extreme. They point out that all you have to do is adjust the spin axis a little and it lengthens the day that Joshua talks about. And as a piece of thing. Now, some of you are probably saying, Chuck, that sounds kind of interesting but boring, because you can't really believe that Mars came that close to the Earth. I mean, that's all sort of, it's cute. I, incidentally, as an aside, so you sort of know where I'm coming from, I think there's so much that they have discovered and tied together in the model. I think the model's probably has a lot of credibility. But I'm also beneficiary of something else that I haven't shared with you yet. How many of you know the Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels? Have you all remember Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels? You probably never realized how valuable that book would be to you tonight, but tonight I'm going to share some things with you. Jonathan Swift was an Irish wit or satirist. He published a series of stories, fiction stories, the travels of Lemuel Gulliver, and he goes to all these interesting places. And most of us remember Lilliput, the little place of the little tiny people. But there's a place called Laputan where Gulliver travels. And what Gulliver discovers there is that the astronomers in this land, described in Gulliver's Travels, make fun of the Earth because they've discovered the two moons of Mars. And in the story of Gulliver's Travels, these guys mention the size and the orbits and the details of the two moons of Mars. And what's interesting here is they don't get them quite right, because by today's astronomers, they'll tell you that actually Phobos and Deimos are the two the two satellites of Mars. Swift said they were about 12,420 miles in effect, and we now know they're only about 8,000. Swift said they had a 10-hour period around Mars, but we now know it's actually 7 hours and 39 minutes. Deimos, which Swift said was about 20,700 miles in effect, we now know is actually 16,670. And he said that period was about 21 and a half hours in the opposite direction of the previous one. We know it's actually 30 hours and 18 minutes in the opposite direction of the previous one. So Swift was a little bit off. But let me tell you some interesting things. Swift published Gulliver's Travels in 1726. You might just remember that date. The telescope was invented by Galileo in 1610. Okay? And he discovered with that telescope in 1610 four moons of Jupiter. Pretty neat, because they're pretty bright and pretty conspicuous. He also discovered Saturn's rings. Now, this is 1610, essentially. We can move along to about 1781, when Sir William Herschel discovered Uranus. 1787, where he discovered the two moons of Uranus. In 1789, where he discovered the two moons of Saturn. Lavoisier, in 1846, discovered Neptune and its moon Triton. Now, recognize, 1610 is a telescope invented. Jonathan Swift writes and talks about the two moons of Mars in 1726, right? It's some 50 years or more later that Herschel discovers Uranus and their moons and so forth. 1846, which is, 120 years after Gulliver's Travels, he discovers Neptune, its one moon. It's not until 1877... 151 years after Jonathan Swift published Gulliver's Travels, that a guy by the name of Asaph Hall, in 1877, shocks the world by using the staff of the United States Naval Observatory with a 15-year-old telescope that was pretty hot stuff in those days, to some extent. He discovers the two moons of Mars. And the world is in shock, because all the textbooks said Mars had no moons. They said that for, more than a century. Now, why was it so hard to find the two moons of Mars? Well, Phobos is actually only 8 miles across. It has only a 5% albedo, which means its reflectivity to sunlight is very little. It's the darkest thing in the solar system. It doesn't reflect much light, and it's very small. It's also fairly close to Mars. It's 1/100th the width of the moon, I believe. The Deimos, incidentally, Phobos and Deimos are named Fear and Panic. The reason they are is fear and panic were the companions of the god of Mars in the ancient mythology. Now, as I point, I went through the numbers how Swift was not quite right and modern. Now, what's interesting about this, you start scratching your head and say, well, wait a minute. How the dickens did Jonathan Swift know that Mars had two moons at all, 150 years in advance? Did he have a telescope? Well, he could have had Galileo's. But if he did find something, wouldn't he have reported it to the Royal Society rather than just write it as a piece of fiction in his folklore, okay? And why would people like Sir William Herschel and all the astronomical world in those days be blind to the fact that there were two moons in Mars? They all knew there weren't because they'd look and not see any. So the real question is how did Jonathan Swift know that Mars had two moons? It's clear, as you read the Swift record, although slightly corrupted, somehow there was knowledge available to Swift that Mars had two moons. They went counter to each other, and they were approximately those orbits and spins, right? The only rational answer is that Swift was drawing on some records from earlier folklore that had to have its origin in an eyewitness account. If Mars was close enough to see these with the naked eye, it would be like 70, 80, 90,000 miles away. And the Jonathan Swift Gulliver's Travel document turns out to be one of several corroborations, if you will, to the idea that the planet Mars was at one time close enough to the planet Earth that its moons, very difficult to see, were visible to an eyewitness. And somebody, in one of these catastrophes, wrote down enough to get a feeling for their size and period. The period estimates are amazing. They're surprisingly close. And that record, corrupted though it may have been, was a piece of folklore that Jonathan Swift could draw upon to you know, put his tongue in his cheek and color his satire, which Gulliver's Travels, of course, is a satire on man and his institutions and so forth. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing. As I look at all of this and try to synthesize it, sure, it expands my view of what the Bible's all about, because it makes me a little less uncomfortable with the Long Day of Joshua, and we'll come back to that here before we close. But something else just comes home to me. You know, we look at these guys in their ancient cultures, and they're abstractions. They're little they're records on cute Egyptian monuments, or they're sort of unreal people we read about of so many thousands of years ago. Can you imagine these guys living in a world where nothing is certain? Can you imagine them knowing from their records and from their histories and from the folklore that about every 108 years, something weird can happen? Heavy. Building cities that ain't permanent, because the entire cities get wiped out every 108 years or so. And as those that saw it or read the records of their grandparents who saw it or what have you, hear these records of how Mars comes up out of the sun and appears in a matter of a day, comes and goes, where it's 50 times larger than the moon, and it's accompanied by lightning bolts, volcanoes, eruptions, tidal waves, meteor showers that land and kill people, bolides that explode and wipe out entire countrysides, all associated before, during, and after the near miss, and that this becomes a repetitive thing. The belief that these guys have, but I don't think it's been proved, is that Stonehenge may do more than just predict solar eclipses. That it may, its real purpose may have been to try to predict the next catastrophe scheduled by the ancients. There is evidence as they look at it, there's hints, I should say, that the ancient tribes were aware of the cycle, at least to some degree, and planned their battles accordingly. And that's one reason they ensconce at different times. To take a city, because there's a probability that a catastrophe will drop the walls, which would favor the attackers rather than the defenders, and those kinds of things. So as we read these terrified peoples, we can't help but be sympathetic, and perhaps we can be, at least in a humanistic sense, a little more tolerant, that they would tremble at the names of Mars or Venus or Mercury or Jupiter or Saturn, because the movements of these heavenly bodies correlated with their future, their upheavals, their victories, their defeats. And as we read these strange practices of the Canaanites with Baal and Ashtoreth, obviously we can't condone them, because they're blind to the God of Israel, who revealed himself as a God who cares, a God who redeems, a God who intervenes in the lives of men. Different scenario. We might turn, lest we totally take this excursion without at least focusing on Joshua chapter 10. Joshua chapter 10, let's just skim through it again. We did, I think, last time, but we obviously have the Gibeonites made a treaty that rattled the five kings that make an alliance in chapter 10. Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, gets his buddies together, and they make a league against Gibeon. It's interesting, it's not against Joshua, it's against Gibeon. And so they camp against Gibeon. Now bear in mind, from Gilgal, where Joshua is, which is near the Jordan, you go inland a little bit, there's Jericho, you go uphill a little further, there's Ai, and you go over the hill and you come to Gibeon. And the Gibeonites, of course, find themselves attacked by this league of these five kings under Adonai Zedek. And verse 3, whereupon Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, and to Piram, the king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, the king of Lachish, and unto Debir, the king of Eglon, saying, "Come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel." There's obviously spiritual overtones here too, is that when you have allied yourself with the God of the universe, you can expect that your enemies will align themselves against you. And that's exactly what the Gibeonites discover. And of course, verse 5, "Therefore the five kings of the Amorites," that is the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, "gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their hosts, and encamped before Gibeon and made war against it." So they lay siege in the uphill, in the hills, around the valley that Gibeon is up on a slight rise itself. Verse 6, and the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua into the camp to Gilgal, saying, relax not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. In chapter 9, they had made this treaty with Joshua, and we as we covered then, it was kind of a pretty sneaky, conniving kind of fraud they perpetrated, but nevertheless, Joshua made his commitment, and they all lived with it, and they made this league, and they honored it. And we get right to chapter 10, and they're already calling their trump. They want Joshua to come and save them from their previous allies, but now their enemies that are encamped around them. Now, Joshua does a remarkable thing. He travels about 15 miles uphill through the mountains with all of Israel in a period of about 36 hours. Because, apparently, in fact, if you read the battles of the Bible, the military analyses of this, they're impressed over the march. These guys went right through the night, and you'd think they'd be exhausted by the time they get there. They really pushed, though. So it says, verse 7, so Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand. They shall not a man of them stand before thee. Boy, the extent that God goes to deliver to you is pretty interesting. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and came up from Gilgal all night. In other words, it's an overnight crash program. So they march, the whole men of war of Israel march up from Gilgal. And they catch him by surprise. This is sort of glossed over, but obviously the League of Five Kings against Gibeon didn't expect this. They knew Gilgal was a long way away. They probably didn't expect Joshua to honor it in the first place. And they probably had all kinds of reasons for believing that they wouldn't keep their commitment. Maybe because they knew there was some chicanery involved and figured that would nullify it. Or maybe they figured they would spend a day or two having committee meetings or what have you. Or certainly, even if they decided to come, they wouldn't make it in one day. So they obviously were caught by surprise. And so that's what happens here in verse 10. And the Lord routed them before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth up to Beth-horon, and smote them to Azekiah and Makeda. That's looking ahead a little bit. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were in the going down to Beth-horon, that's the valley on the other side of the mountains, that they going southward, that they're going to flee. They're shocked, they're surprised, so they're in retreat, they're charging down this valley, the valley of Beth-horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them unto Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. Hailstones from heaven, meteorite showers, maybe some bolides, we're not sure. These sound like meteors. Incidentally, to the extent that we're correct in the Steinhauer model, and that Mars had start to make its appearance early in the morning, just about sunrise, maybe shortly thereafter. It all fits because of the whole timing here, but also we would be entering into the sheath, the magnetic and gravitational sheath that surrounds the planet Mars, and be encountering the asteroids and what have you that tag along on these orbits. And so it would be very, very cosmologically or astronomically, if you will, astrophysically, whatever term you want to use, appropriate to expect these hailstones. Now, where we get into, I don't want to make the South sound like it's just nature and it happened this way. It's kind of impressive hailstones because they clobber Israel's enemies. We're going to find out later in a chapter that all of Israel returns to Gilgal. So apparently, the chapter leads us to believe there were no losses. Now, whether there might have been a few minor ones not recorded, it's possible. But the scripture says all of Israel returned, so in a spiritual sense, we accept that. That's what the Holy Spirit would have us believe. Clearly, though, there is some very interesting discrimination by these meteorites, because they seem to be able to tell an Amorite from a Hebrew. And that's better than we could probably do if we met either one of them. They do pretty well. Now, verse 12 is the one that gives everybody the heartburn. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, Son, stand thou still upon Gibeon. Now see, it's early. It's still there in the east. And stand still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. Ajalon's over on the other side. The moon is separated somewhat in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. And is this not written in the book of Jasher? And so the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hastened not to go down about a whole day. Now, this can be explained, incidentally, by simply the shift of the orbits, by the way. That's not obvious until you model it and play with it. But the point is, by shifting the polar orbits and some other things, that would cause the sun not to set in its normal time. So you don't really, interestingly enough, you don't have to have the Earth stopped to have this happen. That's the fallacy that most of us would assume when you think about it naively. But if the polar orbit is shifting and the tilt is shifting, combination of those can keep this, can extend the day. And now what we don't know is what the day extended. It says did not go down for a full day. Is that 12 hours? It's about a whole day. Is that 4, 6, 8 hours? Is it hours of daylight? There's all those issues, and I won't get into that here. The studies tend to hit that head on. Bilikovsky does, and so does the Steinhauer patch models. But anyway, verse 14 summarizes it in a biblical sense. There was no day like that before it or after it that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Now, the Lord's pretty neat because he anticipated this by quite some time, because the mechanics that he invoked are, you know, put up in advance. And that may seem strange, and yet shouldn't surprise us, because the Lord is outside our time domain. When you have a prayer, you're not going to surprise him. He knows what you're going to pray about before you ask it, and he also knows whether you'll answer it before you ask it, and he can have anticipated that. So I recommend you pray without worrying about time domain. He's pretty neat that way. And think of Joshua at that time, because what the Lord had to arrange to take care of the Battle of Beth Horon was long before they crossed the Jordan, and long before they were even in Egypt. It was the Lord apparently put this all together sometime earlier. When he goes into battle, he's prepared for it. And kind of neat. No day like that before it or after it, and that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man and fought for Israel. We'll pick up verse 15 on where it's a cleanup. The main idea here is this battle. We're going to discover that in the book of Joshua, we had, of course, the Battle of Jericho, which is a very special first fruits kind of battle with a lot of mystical overtones. We talked about that. We had the Battle of Ai, which they suffered their defeat. They repented and corrected it and then succeed. And now we have the Battle of Beth Horon. What's going to happen now? When we get to chapter 12, we'll be through with the battles. At the end of chapter 12, essentially a list of all the cities, the city kings. There's 31 of them. Those of you that are mystics may know that the word for God in the Hebrew is El, which numerically adds up to 31. What that's got to do with 31 kings may have nothing to do with it, but it's all included in the price of admission. I know what you're going to do with that piece of information, but I'll throw it out. But the point is we're going to discover from this point on that the summaries of the battles get more and more cursory. The Holy Spirit has chosen to describe these first three in some detail because each one of them have lessons for us. Jericho has its lessons that, in my mind, point to Revelation very strongly. Ai has its spiritual lessons in terms of what it takes to win and lose. And Beth Horon gives us some insight to just how far God will go to intervene on your behalf and mine. But the rest of these battles will be summarized in a more a cursory fashion as we move in further into the book. But I've taken this time together to really go way out of orbit talk a little bit about some of the insights we have from current thinking. Doesn't mean they're right. They're not scriptural. They're just observations. But they do involve synthesis, if you will, of information about our ancient cultures and histories and events recorded in the Bible, but also in many other records, too, that give us a suggestion that the earth was not always the way we seem to have been taught. And I think the more we venture into space, when you get a chance to page through a picture book, there are a lot of these around of NASA photographs from the Viking, Ranger, Mariner series and so forth, and you see pictures of the moons of Saturn, Jupiter, and whatever, close-ups. Fascinating. They have pockmarks just like the moon. And you look at Mars, and you find these large gashes, 2,500-mile valleys that have been carved through by collisions and things. And as we look at all this, it doesn't take any imagination to realize that the catastrophe theory of history, if I can call it that, makes much more sense than some kind of uniform, some clock that's been wound up and been running uniformly ever since some cosmic Big Bang or something. Clearly, there have been adjustments and give and take in these orbits. And it looks like God may have orchestrated these to serve his purposes to pace the biblical history. And so as we read the scripture, it's interesting that you and I, with the Bible in our laps, can read a record that's more accurate, more authoritative, more descriptive, more precise than the textbooks that we may have been grown up with as kids, or that may be on our library shelves today. and probably far more accurate than the textbooks that will be revised and put on our library shelves tomorrow, that God himself has spoken in a way that is transcends man's theories, be they these ones that we've shared today or others. And so as we read this, in my mind at least, as a guy who's basically a technologist and engineer by training, I get far less uncomfortable with things like the long day of Joshua or Noah's flood or what have you, as I realize that the critics and the people who disparage these tales are shockingly uninformed. And I don't mean just in a biblical sense. I mean even in an astrophysics sense. Let's stand for a closing word of prayer.